My name's Roy Cost, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm a little bit nervous tonight, y'all, and it's not because of what you think. Really, it isn't. Quite some time ago, a number of years ago, my wife bought for me some of the most beautiful, sexy, purple satin shorts you have ever seen in your life. And the next Saturday night, I had something like this to do, and I wore those suckers. And I very modestly and with all humility, I got to tell you this, I cured a lot of souls that night. I mean, it was, with all humility, it was beautiful. I just did great. And I decided that night that any time I do this again, by God, I'm going to wear those purple shorts. I got to tell y'all something. This is not the first time I've done this week, and those shorts were not any, well, I'm having to do this tonight without my security blanket, you know. I'm awfully glad to be here. This is a particularly big thrill for me. There's a lot of people here tonight that I care an awful lot about, and I'm not going to point out any names. There's no need to do that because I'd forget somebody and I'd get them mad at me. But the ones that I think about the most is when you was running down the list a while ago about the length of sobriety, 6 months, 3 months, and so on. And you get it on down there, and I know in a group this big we've got some brand new people here, man. And that's what we're here for, isn't it? As far as I know, that's what we're here for. Rick raised the traditions just a few minutes ago when he talked on that. I always have to listen. When I listen to that thing, I pause. When he gets to the fifth tradition, and he says something about the alcoholic who still suffers. For God's sake, we know that in a group this big, there's some brand new people here. And if you're like I was when I got here, you are different from anybody that ever lived on the face of God's green earth, aren't you? And you know what I did? I've talked to Dick about this and Harlan and a few other people today about this thing. I believe this as much as I believe anything, and I'm believing it more and more and more all the time. We are the products in here of what we hear the first one or two meetings we come to Alcoholics Anonymous. In very few instances, we seem to change later on, but we seem to be the products of what we start out to be in Alcoholics Anonymous. And by God, let's get some accurate information out to these people. Let's get some good, solid, accurate information. Because when I got here, I know you've heard other speakers say this, but I'm going to say it anyhow. I was the most different person on God's earth. And I know you've heard other guys say this thing, but I'm going to say it again anyhow. I could tell that. And I don't think this is altogether alcoholic. I could tell that by looking at you guys. Because I didn't look like you felt like you looked. And nothing made me feel like you looked quite as much as a little bit of booze. And the insidiousness of what's wrong with me is that it worked, man. It worked beautifully. And I knew something else, y'all. I knew I was not an alcoholic. I knew that above all else. I knew I had to get my wife off my back. And I knew I had to get that company I worked for off my back. But I knew, because see, I knew what an alcoholic was, right? I knew an alcoholic was a person that had a problem with alcohol. And unlike a real alcoholic, I had a hell of a lot of problems that had absolutely nothing whatsoever to do with drinking alcohol. And the kicker to that was this. Those problems were far, far, far more intense when I was not drinking alcohol. Weren't they? Okay? I couldn't be an alcoholic. And if you're sitting back there in the same position and you know you're not an alcoholic, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. And you know what my mother and dad said and the preacher said and all those good people said? They said, Rod, if you'll quit drinking, everything will get better. And they lied like a damn dog. Didn't they, really? Because when I quit drinking, you have taken away from me the only way that I've got of dealing with reality. And it didn't get better. It got worse. And I want to thank God for one thing. I want to thank God for alcohol, man. Not Alcoholics Anonymous at this point. Later on, we'll do that one. But at this point, alcohol. Because without alcohol, you know what we hear in Alcoholics Anonymous? You hear it all the time. Hell, I lost a wife. I lost a job. I lost a due to drinking alcohol. Hell, I did too. But you know something I didn't hear then I hadn't heard yet? I'd have never had guts enough to marry that woman without alcohol. I'd have never had guts enough to get that job I think so much out without alcohol. And I believe this, y'all, as much as I love being down south this far, you can say y'all. I believe this as much as I believe anything on earth. The only treatment I had for what's wrong with me until I found Alcoholics Anonymous was alcohol. Okay? And I believe something else. I believe without alcohol, I'd have blown my brains out before I was 30 years old. Okay? It wasn't my problem. It was a solution to my problem. I got to tell you something else. When I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I hadn't had any fun in a long, long time. I have had more fun. There's some people in here I've been with quite a little bit the last 2 days. I've had more fun today, man, This day that I had all the years for, I found alcoholics. Now, you know something? It ain't got a damn thing to do with anything that's happened today. It ain't got anything to do with anything I think that's going to happen tomorrow. It ain't got one thing to do with the fact I haven't had a drink of alcohol today. It has happened, y'all. It has just happened since I became a step working and mainly a reworking involved participating member of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And therein, as I see it, is the miracle of what's going on in my life. Man, it ain't no miracle I hadn't had a drink. There's not a drunk in this room that hadn't gone 24 hours without a drink. If all you want, we hear it all the time. Just don't drink 24 hours at a time. Bull ticky. If all I want is 24 hours of sobriety, all I got to do is go downtown Springfield, Missouri, and slap a cop. You guys are looking at tonight a guy that always thought this, life has got to begin tomorrow. Okay? By God, today wouldn't it? Life has got, that's not true, is it? Since I got into Alcoholics Anonymous, I started giving to you people. And here's the kicker, expecting absolutely nothing whatsoever in return. God just giving it away. My cup started filling up, man. And it's so full tonight, I can't hardly stand it. I've had a fantastic day today. It's been a great day to be alive. It's been a great day to be sober. I woke up this morning. I know exactly what I did last night. I know whose wife I slept with. And the miracle of that is it was my own. You know? And there's people down here in Arkansas and East Texas that says right there shows more growth than any other area of my life. You know? I'm grateful to be here. I'm grateful to be sober. There's no one that's ever known me or ever had anything to do with me that's not grateful I'm sober tonight, you know. But I'm grateful for something else, and this is extremely serious to me. I'm grateful that for today at least and for some time right now, that craving, the compulsion, the desire, the obsession, the thought of taking a drink of alcohol has been gone, man, from my life. Isn't that neat? It'd be hell if I had to sit around and white-knuckle this thing all the time. But herein lies the kicker to that. That right there can become the greatest enemy I've got on earth. The very fact that I haven't had a thought of a drink today can become the greatest enemy. That enemy of mine is called complacency. Complacency to me being the act of the art of some of us alcoholics to think that once we lose the desire for a drink of alcohol, man, we got this thing made. We don't need it anymore. Complacency is a big... You know what I've done? I've had about 9 fourth steps, I believe it is now. And I can take all of my character defects and put them under one heading, and it's called ego. I have got it made. I don't need you no more. My complacency can lose that precious wife that I just practically worship. It can lose that job that I love so very much. And it can and has lost its sobriety in the past. Go talk a pot full about it. I never get up here without talking about complacency. I'm up here for a couple of reasons. One of them is, Jerry called me, your committee asked me to come here. And thank you for that. This is a hell of a deal for me. I love this so very much. It does so much for me to be able to do this thing. I've met a lot of good friends up here. Harlan and Jeannie got, you know, Harlan P. That's Jeannie Petcher's husband. I don't break anybody's anonymity. Harlan, though. That guy's a piece of work. Somebody's telling me about back in his drinking days. He went up to this drunker than the seventh plateau of hell. Went up to this woman's house and knocked on the door. He says, lady, he says, I think I've run over your head. She says, my God, what did it look like? Harlan says, well, it's about that tall, about that long, you know. She says, no, man, no. Before you hit it, he's, ah! Leave me alone, boy. But the other reason I'm here is simply this. This morning when I got up, and for quite some time now, every morning when I got up, I've made a little promise to my higher power. And in that promise, I've said to my very good friend God, I say, very good friend God, with your help, I'll not take a drink of alcohol today, and I always add something to that, and that's this. And I will do, by God, whatever it is I'm asked to do in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, to stay sober and help another alcoholic to achieve and maintain their sobriety. So if you ask me to come to Springfield, Missouri and talk, I'm going to do it. If you ask me to shut up, we'll see what happens when midnight gets here. Okay? But I'm going to do whatever it is I'm asked to do in the program of stay sober. My big book. Seems like the more I get up here, the more I talk about that precious book of experience, our textbook. I don't apologize for that, Mickey, because that book contains, if I had done this thing, That book contains the answer to everything that's going on in my life, all of my life. Now, I did not obviously do that, but it could. It tells me exactly what I'm supposed to do up here tonight. You know that? It says our story is disclosed in a general way what we, not it. We used to be like, God, that gets misquoted in East Texas. Hell, it don't change. It's still out there. I can go out there to the next door and get it tonight. The only thing that's changed is me, Rod Costin. And since I have changed, my perception of it has changed. And it became a tenable place in which for me to live without alcohol. I'm going to tell you very little about what I used to be like. I'm going to tell you what happened. And man, I'm going to get around to my very favorite part. I'm going to tell you what I'm, that's exciting. God, I'm going to tell you what I'm about like now. I did that out in California one time. I got through and this little gal came up to me and she said, Rod, boy, says, you sound like a Baptist preacher. Well, I got to watch that one. Kathy says, I get up here sometime, my shirt tail comes out. I get excited, man, about what's going on in my life. You see, I didn't say that when I was a kid to grow up to become an alcoholic. I said that when I was a kid to grow up to become an airline pilot. And for a number of years, I made the career of flying airplanes and the career of drinking that slop out there work real nice together. And if you can't understand that, you're in the wrong meeting. I can do anything better with two drinks of Scotch whiskey in me, including fly airplanes or make love to a woman. I mean it. I can do anything better. I worked up about 1968 when it became apparent to those people that run that airline that drinking that alcohol was starting to cut in on my flying career, you know. And it had become apparent to me for a long time that flying those damned old airplanes was cutting in on my drinking time. But simply due to the fact that flying the airplanes just to pay the skosh more money than drinking that slop, I came into Alcoholics Anonymous in the fall of 1968. And I came to you people then for one reason and one reason alone, just to save that job. I stayed around here then for 10 months. It's what I look back on now and I call my 10 months of sobriety, you know. But I did do this. I said enough of the right words and I did enough of the right things. I was asked to go speak over at the Harbor Club over in Fort Worth, Texas. A lot of y'all know where that is, I'm sure. And I went over there that night, and I'm here tonight to tell y'all that I laid some alcoholic unanimous on those people that night. I mean, I cured a lot of people. Ain't no question about that. They didn't could disband that group, man. They didn't need no more. You know, I got through and I got back in my old pickup truck. And I started back there in the mid-cities area between Dallas and Fort Worth where I live, and I got to thinking about this thing. And I saw no reason why I couldn't take all of your stories and combine them with my stories and all that vast wisdom that I'd acquired in that 10 months and go back to drinking normally, whatever that is. The only thing about it is this, y'all. I didn't have no place to go back to. I had never drank normally. Last year sometime, I was asked to go, that's when I met Harlan and Jeannie, as a matter of fact. I was asked to go talk at a little convention up at Bull Shoals, Arkansas. And on the way up there, Kathy and I drove up there. And going up there, we drove through a little town of Darnell, Arkansas, on the Arkansas River. And as we drove through there, I said, babe, right up there is Mount Magazine. That's where on July the 4th of 1950, I had my first drink. I was 17 years old. Now, you great mathematicians, don't get with it. I'm 54, okay? You do this at a banquet sometime, they'll screw up a lot of tablecloths, you know. I had in my, if any of y'all are pilots out there, this is going to ring a bell. I had in my pocket a commercial flying a pilot's license. I was 17 years old. If you're pilots out there, you know something, don't you? You got to be 18 to have one of those dudes. Back in those days, you didn't have to have a birth certificate back up. You had to have your mother's signature. She didn't know she'd done that, and I was eaten up with guilt. I weighed 108 pounds. I was 5'2" tall. I had a little high, squeaky voice. And I was terrified of women. I went up on that hill that day. I'd never even smelled alcohol to my knowledge of my life. My boss gave me all the Schlitz beer I wanted to drink that day. And here's a kicker y'all can identify with. I drank more than anybody else on that mountain that day, yet I was the only one sober enough to drive off that mountain that day. And when I got off that sucker, I was 6'2". I weighed 180 pounds. I had a deep John Wayne voice, and I called up a little gal down in Malvern, Arkansas, and asked her to marry me. And alcohol became the solution, not the problem. The solution to every problem I ever had on earth, okay? Was I finished? No, I wasn't finished. I'd never heard of a bootlegger, I don't think, in my life, but I found out what one was right quick, and I called him up. And I'd never heard of Scotch whiskey, but it sounded interminably sexy to me, didn't it? So I said, man, give me a bottle of Scotch whiskey. I woke up the next morning on the Arkansas River Bridge. That's the one we were talking about a while ago, you know. I had a big gash in my head, my britches, my shirt were halfway torn off. I mean, was I an alcoholic? I don't think so. However, 15 seconds later, I sat bolt upright and I says to myself, Rod, boy, the feeling you got getting there is worth it. Okay? And I believe this as seriously as I can say this one, y'all. I believe that any time the obsession comes across this boy's mind of what alcohol is going to do for me, and it exceeds the reality of what it's going to do to me, I believe at that moment old Rod's an alcoholic. That's what I wanted to go back to drinking normal to that day in Fort Worth. Now, you know what I did. I stopped at a liquor store in Fort Worth, Texas. I got me a bottle of scotch and I woke up the next morning in Fort Worth City Jail. And I started filling in all of the squares that I had never filled in before. I'd never had a DWI. I couldn't keep from getting a DWI. The marriage of mine, I was on my second marriage, by the way. It wasn't going too good because of that drinking. It started falling apart at the seams due to that drinking. And that job of mine, you remember the job I quit drinking for? I became absolutely terrified. Not of flying airplanes, but of myself. Man, I was going to show up at the airport smelling a little bit too much like booze to get on that airplane and go to work, you know? Or y'all ever shake? God, I shook. Shaking too much to even sign a clearance to get on the airplane and go to work. Or, as undependable as my drinking had become, I was going to show up out there someday absolutely knee-crawling, lap-licking, drunk. Which, of course, you know, I finally did, right? Chief Pilot met me at the door of operations that day. I'll never forget it. He'd been watching me for a while anyhow. And I like to pause here and say that was not paranoia. That sucker had been watching me for real. He turned me around. He took me back to the parking lot. And on the way to the parking lot, he fired me. Having just lost the job that I worshipped due to drinking, on the way home, I stopped and got a quart of scotch to drink. Was drinking my problem? No. Getting fired was my problem. The scotch was the answer to my problem. I'll try not to get too redundant on that. But we get so carried away in Alcoholics Anonymous, don't we, a lot of times about talking about our drinking problem. Hell, if you got a drinking problem, quit drinking, everything gets fine. I got a drinking problem, I quit drinking, I get suicidal. Well, I've got to treat something other than my alcohol, haven't I? I've got to treat my alcoholism. Well, with that job, went that home, practically everything else I had. But with a little money I had to me, I moved off back up to Arkansas up there, and I put in a building material business. And due to the fact I hired me two really good managers up there, that thing took off from the very outset, and it did fantastic. And also, you know, due to the fact I hired those two good managers, Sheila remembers that, I know, it didn't cut into that old drinking time one bit, did it? And it was by April the 11th of 1971, old Rod was in sad shape. I weighed 118 pounds. Now, you can look at me. I ain't built for no 118 pounds. I could no... See if you can identify what it is. I could no longer do anything without taking a drink of alcohol first. Then I could function a little while. Remember that? That day, however, I went back to my mother's house. Having had all of old Rod I could take, man. I'd already had all of you I wanted. That day, however, I went back over and I had all of me I wanted. And I called the number of Alcoholics Anonymous over in Hot Springs, Arkansas. And I'll not forget the guy that answered the phone over there. I'll bet you some of y'all know him. His name was Jim G. Okay? Jim later became my sponsor. Now, I spent about 4 or 5 minutes telling Jim just what a lousy condition I was in. And I must have been quite effective because Jim bounced back and said, Rod, boy. And everybody calls me boy. He says, Rod, boy. He says, can you make it to Hot Springs? And I said, quite frankly, Jim, I don't know whether I can make it to Hot Springs or not, but I will try. And then Jim said something to me, y'all, that I don't want to ever get behind the podium of Alcoholics Anonymous without saying, or I certainly don't want to ever forget when I'm working with new people. Jim says, Rod, says, you try to make it to Hot Springs, boy. Says, but if you can't, I will come to you. God, the 12th step of this precious program of ours, don't say they're supposed to come try to take this message away from us. It says we're supposed to try to carry the message, and Jim was willing to carry this message to this poor dying drunk out there about 20 miles out in the country. Hell, I made it over there, no big deal. I met Jim in the back of his little appliance store over in Hot Springs. And I used to get up here and say, we talk to Alcoholics Anonymous. That's not true. I started giving him some of that vast wisdom of mine. And Jim says, shut up. It didn't work. Jim talked to Alcoholics Anonymous all that afternoon. He took me to a meeting that night. And after that meeting, he took me home with him. I spent the night with he and his family there in Hot Springs. The next day, we went back to that place. And if he had any work to do, he didn't do it. Because, again, he talked to Alcoholics Anonymous to me all day. That night, another meeting, and when that thing was over with, I got in that pickup truck, man, and I headed back to my mama's house, and I felt pretty damn good. For one thing, I had the people that don't understand alcoholism don't understand this, but y'all understand it. I had had the first meal, man, I'd had that I could keep down, and I locked up pretty good. Next morning, I got up, I went over to my office, and I got those two managers aside, and I said, boys, get it back in a minute. I said there's going to be some changes made around here. But one thing I said, well, I'm not going to be around here much for a little while. Well, that really wasn't any great news to me. Yeah. But I said, I've got to get myself sober. And the only way I know how to do that is to get myself totally, completely, absolutely immersed in Alcoholics Anonymous. And brother, I did it. When I wasn't in a meeting, I was with Jim or some other AA member. And when I wasn't with them, I was into that big book that I just dearly love. And I was into 12 and 12. And very quickly, my life started really getting a whole lot better. And just as soon as it did, I did something that I would literally kill somebody I sponsor for today. I started redating my first wife. Come on, y'all. We ain't talking about the one that had just divorced me for alcoholism. We're talking about my first wife, okay? She and our two boys lived down in Dallas, and every other weekend I'd go down to Dallas and see that gal. And then on the alternating weekend, she'd come to, man, it looked like we was going to be able to put something back together again, you know. It wasn't going to be like that first time. Any good alcoholic, it's worth a damn. I don't care whether it's Arkansas, Missouri, Texas, where you got to be married at least once time you're 16. You know that. We'd put it off. She'd been 18, I'd been 19. And she'd been, that first time, she had been the cutest, sexiest. God, that was a knockout. And I hadn't been so real bad either. You know, I'd been a knight on her white horse in shining armor. It wasn't going to be that way this time, brother. I mean, that woman had a lot of faults, you know, and I knew it. These Al-Anons don't like that much. I hadn't been too hot either. But it did look to me like we were going to be able to put together a very caring, respecting adult-type situation. As it did, I pulled her aside, 2 months sober. 2 months sober. I says, Doris, I love you. I'd like to remarry you. But there's something you got to understand. 2 months sober. I said, I'm an alcoholic. I said, I don't think it had anything to do with our marriage breaking up the first time. Let me tell you what she said. She said, I don't think it did either. Can you believe that? Now, after a number of four steps, it had plenty to do with it breaking up the first time. But I says, I'm sober. I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and you're going to have to buy that, you know. The amazing thing about that, she bought that whole situation. She moved back up to Arkansas with those boys, and we built us a nice home out here on the lake out of Hot Springs. Life could not have been much better, except for one thing. I still wasn't flying airplanes. And I got to tell y'all something. Sometimes I get a little criticism about this, but that's tough. I still love flying those days. I think that's one of the amenities of Alcoholics Anonymous, is learning to love what it is we're doing at the time we do it. I love y'all. I love Kathy. I love Alcoholics Anonymous, but I love flying those stupid airplanes. At that time, it is my understanding that no one in the world, and that's a rather large area, had ever been returned to the cockpit of a major airline flying after having lost their license due to alcoholism. Now it is my understanding that over 840 of us have. At that time, no one had. Let me ask you good drunk something. Ain't that just the kind of a challenge that a really good drunk likes, you know? So I bombarded the airline. I do not tell you the name of the airline. It's rough having to talk to bona fide idiots, you know? Let me tell you why I don't tell you the name of that airline. I was doing this same thing at the Preston Group, I believe it was, down in Dallas one night. I was talking to that group down there, and one of the officers of that company was sitting out there. When I got through, he came up beside the podium, and he does it to me. He says, Rod, boy, he says, don't say American Airlines behind that podium. So I don't say American Airlines anymore. I do say it, y'all, and I say it for a couple of reasons. One of them is this. Seriously. I am so interminably proud of that outfit for being such a leader as they've been in setting up a program for people like me. And it encouraged me to be right here in Alcoholics Anonymous instead of out there dying. Let me tell you how true that is. One time, it's been some time ago now, I was asked to go speak at a thing up in Arkansas, and I had a trip to fly. Now, that's no big deal normally. All I got to do is call around another pilot, swap trips, and get the day off and go do my thing. That time, however, when I called around, I couldn't find anybody to trade trips with me. And I was just about ready to call them up in Arkansas and tell them I couldn't come. When this great big old 6'4" chief pilot of ours, out there, he's got 2,000 pilots just in the DFW area. We've got 6,000 altogether. Found out what I was trying to do. And he called me up 75 miles out in the country, and he said, Rod, boy, he says, you get your butt to Arkansas and do your thing in Alcoholics Anonymous. He says, I'll come out of the office and supply your trip for you, and we'll pay you for it. Now, that's what American Airlines thinks about Alcoholics Anonymous. And I suspect it's what any company will think about Alcoholics Anonymous once they find out what we are doing for ourselves, not what it's doing for us, what we are doing for ourselves in here. Once they find out that people like me, people like this dying drunk, hasn't had to call in sick one time except for a stupid motorcycle wreck I had. Since I started coming to meetings and not drinking? No. Since I started working the steps. Okay? I'll bet you, now we got 6,000 pilots with American Airlines. I'll bet you I had the worst attendance records in American Airlines before I quit drinking. I quit drinking, and I want you to listen to this. It got worse. I'm serious. You take away my solution. We can and we have. When we started setting up a program with American Airlines for people like me, we can put a date on when I started working the steps. I hadn't called in sick since. If you don't like the way I say it, read on page 133 in the big book. Okay? It's the neatest thing. You know something? Going to meetings and not drinking, don't know what, treat my alcoholism then, or relieve my alcoholism, than a 16-year-old boy going to church and leaving the girls alone relieves his sexual tension. The program of Alcoholics Anonymous has to do, we're going to talk a lot about steps, with working the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Okay. There's another reason I say the name of that airline, though. There's some words I can't take. I bet you can understand this. I can't take absolute words. I can't take the word can't. I can't take the word you must. I can't take the word never, and I can't take the word don't. And this son of a bitch came up to me and says, don't say American Airlines behind that podium. So I don't say it anymore. But it's the reason I think that Larry started off the fifth chapter when he read it, when Bill wrote the fifth chapter with the word rarely. Bill Wilson knew that if he put never have we seen a person fail, that'd be me and 50% of you people had gone out that back door. Don't say never to me. That was on page 58, wasn't it? Page 59, he got down to those 12 steps, y'all. Those 12 steps that I literally must work and rework. In order to have the kind of life out there that's smooth and easy without alcohol coming in and making it smooth and easy. And he says, hey, old Rod's down here in Texas in training for this outfit. He says, I'm going to suggest it to him. He'd used the word must 74 times, but this time the mighty steps. He says, now, I want to suggest it to old Rod. Got off my tail a little bit. I'm going to apologize for that. I enjoyed the hell out of it. I got back with the airline. I convinced them to change my firing to a medical leave of absence if I could get the federal government to reissue my license to fly. I think they thought they were safe. You know? But being the con artist that some of us drunks are, I got the airline to let me use their medical department to convince the federal government to reissue the license to fly, and there, 3 months from the time I was grounded, I was back flying for the airline. Life could not have been, there is no question, life could not have been any better. We continued to live up there in Arkansas and run that business, and I commuted to Texas and flew my trips. Life could not have been more manageable. Don't forget that one. It's on March the 8th of 1977. I brought a 727 trip back into Dallas-Fort Worth Airport. I had 2 or 3 hours to sit around before I caught an airplane to ride back up to Little Rock, back to my home and my business and so forth. While I was sitting around there waiting, I got a telephone call from Arkansas. It was from a guy. His name was Jim also. He lived on the cove there on the lake where I live. Jim said, Rod, there's been an accident up here, boy. Well, my dad had been real sick for a long time. Since the advent of my sobriety, God, Dad and I got so close. I was afraid something. I said, my God, Jim, is it Dad? He says, no. He says, it's an accident. He says, it's been a burglary or something at your house. There's been a shooting. He said, Doris is dead. Your wife is dead. Well, you know that there's no need to go into the feelings and emotions we have. Everybody in here probably lost someone close to them. But I got something I want to tell you about this thing, y'all. Don touched on it so beautifully last night. In the short period of time it took an airplane to get from Dallas to Little Rock, word spread across the state of Arkansas to the extent that when I got off that airplane at Adamsville in Little Rock, it looked to me like the entire terminal building was absolutely packed full of my Alcoholics Anonymous buddies from across the state of Arkansas, giving me that usual solid support that I'd grown so accustomed to. Y'all tell me something. Now, I don't knock church. There's no way it works for millions. But is there a facet of the society of the human race that gives us the kind of support that we get in here? And those people didn't leave me. They didn't mouth this thing. They took me back to Mother's house. And they didn't leave me. They stayed with me day and night till after that funeral. And they didn't leave me. They took me right then back to Mother's house right after the funeral. I changed into blue jeans and they took me, man, to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting in Hot Springs. Next morning, yeah, I'm not in bad shape. I went to Dallas. I flew a three-day trip. I didn't have to miss a trip due to that. And another interesting thing, another terribly interesting thing. The thought of taking a drink of alcohol had not even slightly crossed my mind. I had me a pot full of Alcoholics Anonymous going at the time, didn't I? Flew that three-day trip. I went back to Arkansas, and that 3 days, word had spread across the state up there, man. And my next-door neighbor's wife, the woman that had found my wife dead, was also the person that had killed my wife. Further rumors had it that my next-door neighbor's wife and I were having an affair. When I don't take too long, you know, for rumors like that to get just a little out of hand. They had her arrested for first-degree murder in 2 weeks. Now, this is funny now, but it damn sure wasn't funny then. I was the only guy in the state of Arkansas taking up for that woman, which did not do a whole lot to quiet those rumors about that affair, you know. Her trial was set for June the 1st that year. I came in off of another trip the day before that thing. I was sitting over at Mother's house. The telephone rang. It was the cops downtown. They wanted me to come down and answer a few questions that they were the answers to which they were using the trial the next morning, starting the next morning. She woke sober right. I didn't have anything to fear anymore, right? I'll flirt with the cops. I jumped in the car. I went downtown. I parked across from the police station, got out of the car. Two plainclothesmen came up behind me, twirled me around, slammed me up against the car, put the handcuffs on me, and arrested me for capital felony murder. At that time, I thought first-degree murder is the worst charge they had. That ain't so in Arkansas. I don't know about Missouri. Capital on the front of that sucker's mean they can ask for the death penalty. They took me across the street, up the stairs, and threw me in jail, sober. Don't try that. It's bad drunk, right? So, don't try it sober. It's not good. It's not good. I stayed in there 2.5 days. We had to come up with a $250,000 bond to get out of that thing. And when I got out, I didn't go to Mother's house. I didn't change clothes. I went straight to my sponsor. And I says, Jim, Arkansas has just gotten a skosh too damn small for me. I says, my wife's dead, and here's one for you. I'm unemployed again. Because you can't fly for the airline while you're under indictment for a felony. So pending the outcome of that stupid trial, I was unemployed again. I said, Jim, my wife's dead. I'm unemployed. I'm under indictment for murder. If I can't, I'm going to get the judge to release me from the jurisdiction of this court till my trial comes about. I'm going to let those two guys run that business of mine. I'm going to move to Texas. And I did that. To make a terribly long story short, that's exactly what I did. And some interesting things happened, y'all. I moved back to North Dallas in an apartment by myself in an area where I knew absolutely no one. And that's tough on me. I'm a lousy loner. My wife was dead, I was unemployed, I was under indictment for murder, and listen to this one. My life was going absolutely fantastic. Simply because I was involved right here in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Is it any wonder, y'all, that I get a little forensically predisposed to acrimonious recalcitrance? Oh, really? When some dodo comes to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting 5 times in a row with some little nitpicking problem and says, I can't get out of my misery until so-and-so happens. Bull ticky. As we say south of the border. I don't give a damn what's going on in my life. The 12-step program of Alcoholics Anonymous, when worked and reworked on a very repetitive basis, will allow me to ride just a skosh above it. I don't care what's going on in my life. My life was going absolutely fantastic. I did something else that summer. I started dating my little redhead down here. And simply due to the fact that Kathy had just gotten out of a very rotten marriage. And simply due to the fact of all that I was going through. Well, let me try that one once more. I don't think my language can embellish this near enough. This is on page 68, page 83, and page 124 in the big book, if you don't believe it. We do not get good out of bad. We do not get good out of good. We get good out of bad. And he said once more. Simply due to the fact that Kathy had just gotten out of a very rotten marriage. And simply due to the fact of all the crap going on in my life. Kathy and I got closer than we could have any other way. Okay? That makes sense? And just as soon as I saw that our relationship was becoming something other than a platonic relationship. Anybody ever heard of an alcoholic having a platonic relationship? I pulled Kathy aside and I said, just like I had Doris, except now we're talking from 7 years sobriety instead of 2 months or what. Does that make any difference, does it? I said, Kathy, baby, I love you. And I mean that tonight 10,000 times more than I meant it that night, y'all. And I'd say that. I even said that when she wasn't there. I said, I love you more than you possibly love you any other way than what's going on in our lives right now. And I said, if I ever get out of this thing without going to the electric chair, going to prison for life, or something like that, I want to marry you. But there's something you got to understand. You got to understand, kid, old Rod's an alcoholic. By now, everybody in the aviation business from coast to coast knows old Rod's an alcoholic. But I says, I'm sober. And my sobriety is the most important thing on earth to me. And if you choose to marry me, kid, you're going to have to come in second to my sobriety. Do you understand that? And I don't want to ever get up here, y'all. I mean this with all my life. I don't want to ever get up here without saying that Kathy was then and is now the most understanding, supportive person I've ever known. It makes me awful lucky, doesn't it? Makes me awfully lucky. Stand up. But I know an awful lot of people, particularly some people that I sponsor, whose spouses and families do not support them in that matter. You know what? We always talk about these Al-Anons being controllers. We don't do too bad ourselves at times. I tried to start running Kathy's life that summer. Her mother and dad only lived about six Kathy flies, too, by the way. They only live about 6 miles from me. Look here, Kathy, now we talk about love, man. We talk about marriage. We talk about good stuff. And she would not introduce me to her mother and dad. And it just bugged the hell out of me. And as it did, I bugged the hell out of her. You know, one day, Kathy was out on a trip, and I was still off flying, right? It came to this little phlegmatic mind of mine just what a ridiculous position I was putting her in. And this little scenario crossed my mind of what it might be like. She'd go to her mother and dad, and she'd say, Mother and Dad, this is Rod. He's a guy I love very much, guy I want to marry. He's half again my age. He's been married a half a dozen times or so. He's unemployed. He's an alcoholic. And he's under indictment for murder. But other than that, he's a hell of a nice guy, right? I knew I had me a winner, though. I took her back up to Arkansas. And I introduced her to my little 4-foot-10-inch Indian mother. I'm Indian and Scotch, y'all. I'm Indian by birth and Scotch by absorption. Mother pulled me aside and she says, Rodney Dale. She calls me that because that's what she named me when I was a baby. She says, you finally found one that deserves you. Can you imagine? Only a mother. I got something I got to tell you about Kathy and I, and this isn't necessarily original, but I want to say it anyhow. I believe this with all my heart tonight. I am married to what I believe to be the world's most beautiful, sexy, sweet, lovable, irresistible, adorable, brilliant woman on earth. I mean that. And you guys can't have her. But I got something to tell you. You two tonight, this night, can go to bed with the world's most beautiful, sexy, sweet, lovable, irresistible, adorable, brilliant woman on earth if you will treat her that way. I told that one night, I believe it was over, one Saturday night, over in Shreveport. And you never heard the applause way back in the back there. And I got through it. I was kind of proud of myself, you know. And I told the guy chairing the meeting, I said, boy, I sure got the attention of one of those alcoholics. He said, that wasn't an alcoholic. That was an Al-Anon wanting to be treated better. I have never said this, but I've thought about it a lot lately. The guy I sponsored has been having a little trouble. I've talked to him a lot about it. Y'all, I know the men in here. If you lie about this, you'll lie to me about anything. Do you remember the first night? And I suspect the women remember this, too. The very first night, I don't know whether it's your wedding night or just a cheating a little bit before that. I couldn't care less. That feeling you had, becomes that heart's up in here and the 200 beats a minute pulse rate. Everything, she is the most fantastic thing that ever was. And we sit around and wonder all the time, what happened to that feeling? I suspect it's because I'm not treating her like I treated her that first night. I believe that with all of my life. What the hell? My trial came about January the next year. I'm going to tell you two things about that trial. Simply because they relate to Alcoholics Anonymous. One of them is simply this. If anybody in here doing their fourth step and you have any trouble with it, maybe I can help you. But I know a little prosecuting attorney down there in the state of Arkansas that damn sure came up with some stuff out of my past I forgot to put in my fourth step. My dear deputy. But the other one is this, y'all, and it's terribly neat. It's a little difficult to put in words, but let me give it a shot. I bet you can understand this. I was starting to have some trouble with my thinking. Okay? I was starting to doubt God, man. Let me tell you how it was going. My thinking was going like this. Look, God, you know, here I've been sober 7.5 years or so now. I've given you the best 7.5 years of my life. I've been out of myself. I've been into others. I've been working your stupid 12 steps over and over and over. What the hell are you doing to me, God? You know? And I started getting a resentment about this situation. I said, and some of you wise, those God Missouri's got them too. You know, the grinning, happy, acting, stupid, sober, know-it-all. You came up to him and you says, Rod, if you resent a situation, if you find any gratitude about that situation, where's that going? But I'm hurting, man, and I want to take some directions. And I even did a little mini four-step on this thing, and I could find absolutely no gratitude about what was going on. And then it happened. The little prosecutor attorney for finding out I was an alcoholic, he decided he's going to make a moral issue out of this thing, and he released it to the press. Some of y'all may remember this thing. He released it to the press, far and wide, man, TV, radio stations, newspapers, and all. Oh, Rod's an alcoholic. Well, my attorneys had no recourse but to bounce back with, you bet your sweet booty bone the kid's an alcoholic, but he is a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous and has been for 7.5 years, you know? Now, I had nothing to do with that thing, but my anonymity was busted far and wide, and then it happened. Twice during the course of that trial, two separate men, strangers, call my mother's house and says, hey, if this boy can stay sober, going through what he's going through with, and doing the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, by God, we're going to give it a try. Okay? Now, I don't have any way of knowing whether those guys stay sober or not. I have no way of knowing that. That's my very good friend God had in mind, and I better know this. As soon as it came across this little bitty mind of mine, it's something good was coming out of this ridiculous mess I had going. I couldn't keep a little gratitude from slipping, and as soon as I did, the resentment left and it never came back. And I want to tell you something. Kathy can verify this. My mother and dad, my entire family, and I had a cotton-picking ball during my murder trial. Trial lasted 8 days, jury's out 35 minutes, and obviously they came back with the verdict not guilty. What happened was this, and I'll make this very brief, because somebody always asks me after the meeting if I don't do it. The lesser prosecuting attorney, and what we assume having a very weak case, that's an assumption, that is not a fact, went to that little gal next door and convinced her that he just might be able to put her away for life on that first-degree murder charge. But if she wanted to, she could plead guilty to second-degree murder, plea bargain, naming either her husband, me, or a third party whose name as yet they've come up with as having corresponded with her to do this thing, and she'd get 12 years, get out in 2 years, she'd get out in 2 years to the day. End of the trial came, getting back to the flying came, the celebration of all those things came, and still, man, not a thought of taking a drink of alcohol. And it was in July of that year, 1978, that Kathy and I were married, and I will not embellish this too much. There's no way on God's earth that a relationship could have been better than this has been. Wouldn't that be a neat ending to a story? It isn't. October of 1979, Kathy put me in the hospital in North Dallas with double pneumonia. And for 10 days, four times a day, they brought me a little pill called Percodan. I'll not say what that gal in Phoenix said the other day when I said that. Way back in the back, she said, oh, shit! I got out of that hospital November 9th, 1979. Kathy took me back to our apartment there in North Dallas. And we hadn't been in there 5 minutes till I figured out an errand for her to run, right? And when I saw the taillights of her car leave that parking lot, I jumped in that pickup truck of mine and I headed for the liquor store. And I ended 8.5 years of this precious sobriety, most of which had been damn, out of me, into you, step-working sobriety. And for 4 months, like in 2 days, I did me some white-knuckle controlled drinking. And, brother, if you ain't never done none of that, take my word for it, don't do it. I believe tonight, for me and me alone, it had been far better to go on right ahead and got with it than to get just knee-crawling, lap-licking, miserable like I got. March the 7th, 1980, I woke up with all of my insanity back. Now, I wasn't drunk. I hadn't been drunk for 4 months. But every thought I had was around alcohol. When could I get out there and give me some? What could I get that smell the least? How much could I drink without getting drunk? Well, get into Montreal on my layover the next night, you know? In time to get down to the liquor store and get me a bottle, or I should have put a bottle in my bag. Man, every thought I had was around alcohol, and I didn't like what I was thinking. And I made a decision. Please hear this, y'all. If there's a group this big, there's never been a group this big in Alcoholics Anonymous, I'll bet you, without somebody sitting back there thinking, maybe I can have a drink. Please hear this. I made a decision to do what turned out to be, in the doing, the most difficult thing I've ever done in my entire life. I made a decision to come back to Alcoholics Anonymous. Sounds simple, doesn't it? It is hell for an arrogant, egotistical maniac like me. Next night, hell. It's a Wednesday night. There was a meeting of the DFW group over at the Dallas-Fort Worth Airport. It was a group over there that I'd been a charter member of, and I went over there. And I went up the door of that damn thing, and I looked inside,
You know, they say there's no seniority in Alcoholics Anonymous, right? I'm going to say this. Kathy just gets me about this bad. If there's no seniority in Alcoholics Anonymous, why do we spend so much time bragging on our dates of sobriety? I looked in that room, and I'm in a business that's total seniority. Total seniority. And I would have been the most senior person there, except for one thing. I'd taken a drink of Scotch whiskey. And I turned around and almost walked away, and I would have and died except for one thing. The guy chairing the meeting saw me. I went on in. He says, is there anybody here who wants a desire tip? And I very ignominiously, very weak-kneed, throwing pride out the window and admitting defeat, got up and went down and got that damn desire. It's the toughest thing I've ever done in my entire life. It's the reason I tell you tonight. It's the last chance for this boy in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's not y'all wouldn't. I know you'd take me back. I know that. But I'll never have guts enough to come back to you again. I believe that. In a business like I'm in, hell, we haul people around 550 so miles an hour. But news and rumors travels kind of slow. And it took almost 2 months before the news, or the fact as it is, got back up to the upper echelon management of the airline. That's another story how that happened, too. That old Rod had been drinking again. And when it got up to the echelon, up to the upper echelon management there, the medical director called me in. And when he called me in, I knew I'd had it. I was grounded again. Because that little exemption I had to get back to flying said, baby cakes, you ain't drinking no more of that slop for the rest of your life, period. I knew I'd... This time, no problem. There was a program set up for people like me. We talked about that a while ago. But it was going to be a bitch. It was going to take months and months and months of dealing with that red tape of the federal bureaucracy. I'm still almost going to tears talking about this part. But the worst part about it was this. Sober, now I'm sober 2 months, man. I'm back into the steps 2 months. I'm back into meetings a day, 2 months. Sober or not, if I was going to ever get back to flying, I was going to have to go into an alcoholic recovery unit, and I did not want to do that. People that know me very well know where it would be very well at all know I hate to stay away from Kathy 28 minutes, let alone 28 days. But if I was going to ever get back to flying those damned old airplanes, I was going to have to do it. So I went up to Denton, Texas, and I entered a treatment center up there at Westgate was the name of it. And I entered that jitter joint with the worst attitude that a body has ever gone into the place. For one thing, like I said, I went in there sober. And it is my opinion that if a person's got to go in a place like that, the son of a bitch goes in there drunk. They are not set up for you sober. You know? I hadn't been up there 3 minutes till I ran across me that counselor up there by the name of John L. Now, I'd met John before, and I had not liked John. This time, however, when I met John, I took me one of those little spot check inventories it talks about in the 10th chapter of the 12 and 12. And I says to myself, Rod, you've never really hated anybody in your entire... John filled in that square for me. I'm here to tell you all tonight I no longer hate John. He's not there any longer, but before he left that place, God, we'd done some very effective work in Alcoholics Anonymous. I hadn't been up there 4 or 5 days, something else happened. A guy on the outside. I'll tell you who it was. It was the guy that had chaired the meeting when I went back and got that damn desire chip. He said something about me that got back to me in the jitter joint that at best was a modicum short of rigorous honesty. Now, my old sponsor, I will talk about my sponsor later, too, old Wino Joe down in Tyler, Texas. He'd say he told an interminable inexactitude. Some bitch lied about me, is what he did. Now, looking back on it from a little distance, a little sober distance, it was really a very innocuous remark. You know, it meant very little. But y'all got to realize something. There's some people in here that's been to these places. You know what I'm talking about. I was sitting up there looking for something to resent, man. And I developed me a resentment against this man like you would not believe. And again, that same bunch of wisos. You know who you are. You came up to me and you says, Rod, you says if you resent somebody, pray for him. Yeah. That has got to be the biggest pile of it out here. But hell, man, I'm hurting. I'm into taking direction, so I prayed for him. I prayed for him and I prayed for him and I prayed for him, but he didn't die, you know. I kept praying for him and praying for him and praying for him. He still didn't die, but let me tell you something. Neither did the resentment go away. And I like to never got into my big book deep enough to find out that I believe it's on page 67. It doesn't say a word in the first 164 pages of my big book about praying for him. It says, do something for him. This is a program of action, not of words. It said, I did something for him. The resentment went away. No big deal. I finally got out of the place and started trying to figure out what happened to me. After 8.5 years of really good sobriety, what in the hell happened to me? You know what I did. I let the little old Percodan pills take the blame for the whole thing. But miracle of all miracles in this boy's life. For once in my life, I did what you people told me to do. Not what they told me up there to do, but what you people in Alcoholics Anonymous told me to do. I started working the steps. Now, if you people in Missouri are like some of the people in East Texas, you might ought to go get a cup of coffee. Because we're going to talk steps for a few minutes. Okay? One and two, no problem. I've been around Alcoholics Anonymous since 1968. I've read every damn thing from General Service Office I can find about the steps. And I've never heard one way, read one way, how you work, take, or do steps one and two. The big book, right after you got through reading just a second ago, it says, being convinced. We're at step three. You bet your bird I was convinced, man. I was convinced I was powerless, and I was convinced there was a power. I got down to step three, and it was totally impossible. Somebody else talked about step three today. Totally, totally impossible. I couldn't even make the decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of anything. But let me tell y'all what I did, y'all. Let me tell you what I did. I went down to the bottom four words of step three as we understood him. I took those four words out and I took them back up to the very first word of the first step. We, W-E, you, me, we, the group. The group. Somebody else said this too, didn't they? And I allowed you people to become my higher power. And you know something? I come from the Bible Belt down there in East Texas and Arkansas, and I was terrified y'all was going to find out about that. But one night, a little meeting down in Athens, Texas, I let it slip out. And you know what you said? It's okay, boy. As we understood him. You let me get back. I don't think I ever would have got my life, my will and my life directed back towards God as such, except for something that happened in Dallas one night. And again, I was doing exactly what I'm doing right now. I was talking to this group down there. And a guy I had as a sponsor at the time, make that one clear, was sitting out in the group listening. And when I got through, I don't even know what I'd said. But he came up and he grabbed me by the arm. And I know it was winter time because he didn't even let me put on my coat. We hadn't even said the Lord's Prayer. He took me out in the parking lot as cold as hell. And he says, boy, he says, I know what's wrong with you in your step three. Now listen to this, y'all, because I didn't like it then and I don't like it now. He says, you have not put yourself into step eight to where you can step nine yourself. And like I said, I didn't like it then and I don't like it now. And I'm going to tell you three reasons why. One of them is this, and if y'all lie to me about this, you lie to me about anything. I don't like anybody telling me anything. The second one is this. You people in Alcoholics Anonymous are really into the program had indicated to me that I might ought to work these steps in order, not jump from step three to step eight. And the other one is this, and I'm not going to argue with you about this, but I have yet to read one word out of the General Service Office literature that says one word ever about me forgiving me. Boy, I get you quiet, don't it? Me forgiving me is not the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Me forgiving me is the results of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Okay? I'll tell you what I did. Let's forward this story now on into the next summer. Everything's cool and smooth in my life again. I'm back to flying airplanes. I come in off of my trip one day. I got into my pickup truck with my Easy Does It sticker on the back of that sucker, and I drove that pickup truck to my house. And I went into my house and sat down in my chair behind my desk, and I got to thinking about this thing. And it suddenly came to me that, Rod, of yourself, boy, you're nothing. Whatever you are, whatever you ever will be, simply is God's. Okay? I let this thing roll around my mind for a little while. Is that a spiritual awakening? I think in a few minutes we'll see that it is. I think we'll see that. I finally got up from behind his desk, out of his chair, and I walked out of his house and I got into his pickup truck with his Easy Does It sticker on it, and I drove to his meeting. And I heard tonight what I have believed for a long time now was his message of Alcoholics Anonymous. And let me tell you something. Nothing in my life has been the same since. And you know what I thought? I thought it had taken me that long to take work or do the third step. That is not what happened in this boy's life. What happened in this boy's life was way back in the wintertime I had done exactly what the damn step said and made a decision. Only made a decision. In the ensuing months, I'd done a very thorough fourth step inventory. I've done a very thorough fifth step with someone else. That didn't work. That's not what the step says. It says with God, myself, and someone else. God, I took my fourth step. I went out. We live out on a lake down there in Texas. I read it out. I hope nobody saw this one. I read it out over the lake to God. I turned back around towards the house, and I read it to me. Then I gave it to someone else. Step six, I become willing to have all those things that had surfaced in step four and five removed. And in step seven, using humility that I had acquired doing a step four and five like my sponsor made me do it, I humbly ask that they be removed. Step eight, page 76 in my big book says we don't make a list. It says we got our list out of our inventory. If we did a good inventory. Step nine, and here's where our dear friend Don P. from Aurora, Colorado came into my life so very dearly. I hadn't been out apologizing. For Christ's sake, I've been out making amends. One is words and one is actions. Amends means mend it. Fix it. Y'all ever had a meeting around here on the ninth step and you get 75 dodos around? And somebody said, who's going to be the chairman, you know? And somebody else says, oh, Dodo Bud's going to be the chairman. Said, what are we going to talk? Step nine. Somebody says, okay, and you go 75 people. You start talking about apologizing. Somebody, the second guy says, I can't say I'm sorry. I just can't. Hell, that's all I ever did. I'm sorry, I'm sorry. That's my fault. I'm sorry, I'm sorry. No. No, step nine says fix it. Fix it, damn it. Step 10, when wrong property, but if I'm to find a God in whom I can entrust my will and my life, I don't do it in step 3, I make a decision in step 3. I do it in step 11. It takes all 12 of these steps, and they worked on a very repetitive basis for me to have the kind of life that's smooth and even out there without alcohol coming in and making it smooth and even. Step 12, what does it say, the first sentence of step 12? Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of attending meetings and not drinking. Hell, that's the way 90% of it do it, isn't it? I've done it that way a long time. No, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. What steps? The first 11. Yes, sir, bud. You can bet it. Having done diligent work on the first 11 steps, sitting behind my desk that day, I had a spiritual awakening. There's no question about it. Let me get to the bottom two-thirds of that step in just a minute. Let's go back to step four just one second. Interesting things happened step four. One of them was Kathy. Kathy wouldn't have done it for anything in the world, but I'd allow Kathy to become more important than my sobriety. A boy of mine up in Arkansas after his mother died. God, we still just cling to each other. We're so close. Jerry. I'd allow him to become more important than my sobriety. I've been thinking about transferring to the West Coast and flying the DC-10, which I subsequently did, and I still am. I'm just not doing it from the West Coast. I'd allow that to become more important than my sobriety. My meeting attendance. Listen to this one, y'all. My four steps were, yeah, man, you're still going to a lot of Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, but the ones I was going to were open speaker meetings, ones where I could take my new bride, not ones where I participate and it got involved. Okay? And my sponsor. My damn good sponsor up in Arkansas. When I left Arkansas, I didn't replace it. Hell, man. I don't need a sponsor. I'm sponsoring a pot full of people now. You see, I had it made. Complacency. Complacency, complacency. I had it made. I'd gone through the death of my wife. I'd gone through losing that job. I'd gone through being on trial for murder without even thinking about taking a drink of alcohol. But once I had let my program slip, S-L-I-P, God, I hear it all the time. We don't slip, we just drink. It's in the book twice, the word slip. Once I had allowed my program to slip to the proper extent, I drank again. The little Percodan pills, I don't want any more of them. They may have been a slight little catalyst to accelerate me back to drinking or back to my relapse or whatever you want to call it in Missouri. But my relapse or my slip or whatever had started months, maybe years. What am I doing about it? That's the interesting part. One thing they told me up there at that jitter joint, they said, boy, said, you get you a sponsor. They said, don't get you no loser because you're a loser. I didn't like the people. I didn't like them at all. And they said, two losers do not a winner make, just like two dummies do not a smarty make get you a winner. Okay? So being a good alcoholic and knowing if one of anything is good, two is better, I got two of them. One of them is old wine old Joe down in Tyler, Texas. I love the man dearly. He watches me like a hawk, very subtly, but he watches me. Harlan, I talked about that before. Watches me like a hawk. Joe has, to this day, never called me by my name. That used to bug hell out of me. It does not bug me anymore, and I've got to figure out why he does that. He wants me to dwell on what I am and not who I am. He wants me to dwell on the fact that I can change everything about my life except the fact that I'm an alcoholic. I can change my religious convictions. I can change my football team allegiances. I can go to Sweden and have a sex change operation, come back and get some of you hotshot lawyers to change my name from Rod to Ron Dean to Betty, you know. But I can't change the fact that I'm an alcoholic. I'm going to either die with this disease of alcoholism or of it. And Joe is trying to teach me that if I will work, and mainly rework the 12-step program of Alcoholics Anonymous on a very daily basis, my chances are real good. I'm going to get to die with it, not of it. Kathy and I did something else. We moved off down out of, we moved back to Arkansas, by the way, now, y'all. But wherever we are, if the meeting is there and the door's open and we're not out doing something like this or flying one of those stupid airplanes, we're there. We're there. We don't miss. Doing something else. I'm trying to get your life and my life more involved with each other. You know? I'm not going to work this thing alone anymore. We've got 12 steps in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and in not one of them does the word I, me, or my appear. Not one of them. But the word we, I, or us appears in 10 out of those 12 steps, and the word we is implied in 6 and 9. One time when I had buried, I was off flying a long time that last time, I counted through the first 164 pages of my big book, the word we appears 1,154 times. The program's not set up. I'm going to ask you to help me. I'm going to ask you why. Don't let me go insane anymore. You know what insanity is to me? Insanity hadn't got a damn thing to do with what I did when I was drinking alcohol. You could take a quart of scotch and pour it down the throat of Pope John Paul II, and he's going to do some of the same crazy insane thing. My insanity has to do with what I'm, my thinking when I'm not drinking. Like when I think, here's a biggie, when I think I run my life alone without the help of you or my very good friend God. My insanity has to do with any time I think I'm anything other than average. Okay? One of the neatest lines in my big book is the first sentence of the second paragraph of the second chapter says, we are average Americans. Hell, man, listen, you're just like me. Before I got through drinking, I thought I was below average. This is a moral thing. I'm below average. Once I got the least bit of sobriety, I got to thinking I was above average. Come on. I had to be, man, to make up for all the crap I dealt you people. I had to be the world's greatest husband, the world's greatest father, the world's greatest airplane or driver, or here's one for you, the world's greatest Alcoholics Anonymous member, instead of just an average American doing the very best I can do. Here's one for you, and this is jitter joint talk, but it's the truth. Insanity has to do with me thinking that I can do the same things over and over and over again and expect different results. Me going to a liquor store back in my old smoking days for a pack of cigarettes. Me going into a bar for a Coca-Cola. Or me running around with my old drinking buddies instead of working with my old drinking buddies instead of running around with you sober winners of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'll ask you to help me see to it something else. I'll ask you to help me see to it that I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. And I don't mean once or twice a week for me. But I mean every damn time that there's an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting anywhere near me that I can get to if... This is a big, 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 big if. If before I go, my primary living obligations are taken care of. By that I mean this, don't let me become an Alcoholics Anonymous. No, honey, I can't go look for a job today. I've got to go to a meeting. Uh-uh. No, that's not the way. I've got a sponsor that says this program has very little to do with drinking or not drinking. It has to do with living. Okay? I've got a sponsor that cut me down on my Alcoholics Anonymous meetings attendance. Can you believe that? He cut me down from the 13 to 18 a week I used to go to, the 5 to 9 I go to now. Joe says this thing is about living, not drinking or not drinking. I got a good life, y'all. I got a very good life. But when I wanted to, I'm going to put it past tense, I could let my gratitude for this great life I've got deteriorate to the extent. Okay? Some of the Al-Anons might identify with this. I bet you can, Jeannie. That I could get down into misery so deep that I absolutely loved it. Come on, y'all. I could get down to misery so deep. Hell yes, man, I've done made it so bad on myself, you can't make it any worse on me. I can walk around that sanctuary of misery. Yep, I mean it. Sanctuary of misery. And just be a cool, cool cat, man. But it's back in those days I wondered what was keeping me sober. I didn't want to come to the meetings, didn't want to work the steps, and you better not share any with me because I had enough crap of my own. Yeah. But I think it had to do with this, y'all. I think in those days it had to do with my memory. I was remembering 12 things that I searched for in the thousands of bottles of scotch's bottoms, and I used to say never found. That's not true. I did find it, or I wouldn't kept going back to it for it. You know? 12 things. If you're into the same big book I am, they're going to sound as close familiar to you. I was searching for freedom, and I was searching for happiness. I was searching for some way to make this miserable life mine meaningful to someone else. I was searching for some way to close the door on the past. I was searching for serenity, and I was searching for peace. I was searching for some way to quit being so selfish, so self-seeking. I was searching for a complete new attitude and outlook upon life. Cindy Meyer, you have a phone call. Cindy Meyer, you have a phone call. I was searching for, the tenth thing I searched for some way to quit fearing people. And here's one for you, an economic insecurity. And you know something I believe, as much as I believe I'm standing up here, I believe that a billionaire can have the fear of economic insecurity. I was doing this one night down in Dallas, and a guy down there, one of the wealthiest men in Texas, I'm sure. My sponsor would say he had enough money to burn a wet mule. When I got through, he came up to me and he says that very thing. He says even a billionaire can have the feeling of economic insecurity. The 11th thing I searched for in the bottom of all those thousands of bottles of scotch was for some way to unravel all the situations that had me bottled. And the 12th thing was for a power, man, that could do for me what I could not do for myself. And then I came in Alcoholics Anonymous tonight. And some of you wisos, the same bunch of you, you showed me the steps on the wall and the traditions and the little plaques around the wall. But one night at a meeting up in Dallas, a little old lady came up to me. And she did it to me, too. She says, Rod, boy, she says, have you ever read the bottom of page 83 and the top of page 84 in the big book? Okay? Now, it's a passage down there that I know you're all familiar with, but with your kind indulgence, allow me to go through with it, because it means so much to me. For one thing down there, y'all, we're going to talk about 12 promises. To my understanding, there's about 147 promises in this book. But those 12 down there are not a result of attending meetings and not drinking. They are a result of working the first 9 steps of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was doing this out in California, or something like this out in California. When I got through, they gave me a little plaque that had the 12 promises on it. But there's something wrong with that plaque. I saw y'all gave one. I still want to see what's on it. There's something wrong with that plaque. Again, somewhere on down the years, I was doing this again someplace. Again, they gave me a plaque, and this had it on there, what was missing from the first one. You know what it was? It was the first sentence of this thing that says simply this. If. Big if. I was sitting in a meeting one day with a guy. He slipped me a little piece of paper on which he had printed the word life, L-I-F-E. And he capitalized the 2 middle letters, I-F, if. Indicating half the spelling of life is if. Just maybe half of life is if. I don't know. It says down there, if we are painstaking about this phase of our development, we will be amazed before we're halfway through. What development? The 9th step. And it goes into what we now call synonymous, lovingly call our 12 problems. So we're going to know new freedom and new happiness. We'll not regret the past. Now, shut the door on it, man. We'll comprehend the word serenity and we'll know peace. No matter how far down the scale we've gone, we'll see our experiences can benefit us. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. We'll lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. So our whole attitude now, look upon life, will change. Fear of people, and here it comes. Fear of economic insecurity. We will intuitively, automatically, baby, we will intuitively know how to handle those situations that used to baffle us. And the 12th promise says, we will suddenly realize that God, not our power anymore, is that God is doing for us what we could not do for us. Isn't that neat? I was so elated when I read that I damn near stopped reading, but thank God I didn't. Because with this alcoholic mind of mine, it wouldn't have been 5 minutes till I'd have doubted those 12 promises. So I read me one more paragraph, y'all. And in it, Bill Wilson, co-founder of this fantastic society of ours, and I got in a lot of problems the other day saying author of the big book, principal author of the big book, asked me a question. He says, are these extravagant promises, Rod? And he answered it. He says, we think not. They're being fulfilled amongst us, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. And then Bill put in that book, y'all, what has got to be the damnedest statement put in any book I've ever heard or ever read out of my entire life. Bill said about the 12 promises, he says, they will always, not sometimes or not maybe, but this arrogant, egotistical, 6'2" Vermont Yankee drunk, as my sponsor would say, had the unmitigated effrontery, to put in that book about those 12 promises, they will always materialize if, half a life, if we work for them. Not me, baby. I ain't believing anything a damn Yankee puts in a book. I ain't going to do it. I may be a drunk, but I'm a southern good old boy. I ain't going to do it. Let me tell you what I did, y'all. Would you believe that it has been 51 years, 5 months, 3 weeks, and 5 days today since Dr. Bob Holbrook Smith and Mr. Bill Griffith Wilson met in a little gatehouse of the Cyberling Estate up there on Portage Path on Sunday, May the 12th, 1935 in Akron, Ohio. Of course, that wasn't the date of our inception, was it? Now, you know why? Because Dr. Bob had to go out and do old Rod Causton a very personal favor. He had to go out and get himself to a little medical convention over in Atlantic City, New Jersey, and get himself knee-crawling left. Why was that a personal favor to me? I'll tell you why. Because on March the 7th of 1980, when I almost turned around at that door of Alcoholics Anonymous and went back out and died, Dr. Bob, figuratively, was standing there and punched me on the shoulder. Now, Rod, you're not the first one that had to come back, boy. I was. You bet your butt it was a personal favor. He came back to Bell on June the 10th, 19th. Of course, that was the date of our inception. My point is this, y'all. It's been over 51 years since that time, and it's something like some of these service people in here could really help me out on this a lot more than I was. It's something like 1,400,000 of us have come into Alcoholics Anonymous and found our lasting sobriety, and not one of us has been able to prove that statement Bill made about those 12 promises wrong. They will always materialize if we work for them. I didn't know Bill Wilson. There's no way I could have. I was still out doing some of my most intense training for Alcoholics Anonymous when Bill died on January the 24th of 1971. But I've got an old sponsor down in Tyler that knew him well. They spoke from the same podium together, and I could sit around and listen to Joe talk about the heritage of where we came from all night long. But I've got this active imagination, and I like to conjure up this little scenario wherein Bill and I might have been... I tell you what, we're sitting on the bank of a creek. No, I tell you what. Sitting on the bank of what used to be Dorset Pond, and the tourists renamed it the Emerald Pond up there in East Dorset, Vermont, where Bill grew up with his grandparents. You remember? And Bill would be sitting there whittling out one of those boomerangs like he did when he was a kid. He'd turn to me, and he'd do it to me, too. He'd say, "Rod, boy, don't you realize, son, that everything that you've ever looked for, everything you ever thought about, everything you ever dreamed of, searched for in the bottoms of all those thousands of bottles of scotch and really, really never found are yours. Simply for the taking? I'm sorry about that. No. Simply due to your willingness? No. Willingness is the key that opened the door. Somebody else brought that up. No. Simply due to your activity. Your action. It's in the book 17 times. Your action in working and reworking the 12-step program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm grateful to Bill. I'm grateful to Dr. Bob. I'm grateful to all of you old-timers that did such a fantastic job of keeping this thing going until this particular drunk here not only needed it but wanted it. But you know something? I got to be careful about my gratitude, even. I can screw that up. Bill had a lot to say about gratitude, didn't he? Not in the big book. Did you know the word gratitude doesn't even appear in the first 164 pages of the big book? But he had a lot to write. He says, "I shouldn't project my gratitude backward to you folks. Period." He says, "I should project my gratitude forward, man." And this is why we're here, y'all. We're going to talk about the 12-step for a couple minutes. Forward to that new guy that's coming through that door back there. Because if that new guy coming through that door back there is a drunk like I was when I got here, we can give him a stack of these big books as tall as this building. And it's going to be a couple of weeks before he's going to be able to read one of them. And if he's like I was when I got here, it's going to be a little while longer than that before he's going to be able to comprehend what he's read. And it just may be, God, I hate cliches and metaphors as much as a person can, but I'm going to have to use one. It just may be that I am the only copy of that big book this guy's going to see. And I want this particular copy to be open, to be understanding, to be helpful, to be willing, to be friendly. But more than anything else on earth, I want this particular copy to be accurate. Don't let me tell this new drunk something, cliches, metaphors, or opinions that may be designed to kill him just because I hadn't got the right kind. For example, don't let me tell him that don't worry about those steps. You just come to meetings and don't drink. You hear it all the time. We'll give you a fast story about that. There's not a person in this room, I bet you, don't own a third edition of the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. In the back of that book are 43 stories. That book came out in 1976. The big book originally came out April of 1939. April 1939 is the first time those 12 steps were ever put in print. Did you know that? Those people that came out of 43 stories in the back of that book had 37 years to work and rework those 12 steps. You know, to my knowledge, all 43 of those people either died happy and sober or are alive today happy and sober. In my car out here, I got a second edition big book. Came out in 1955. There's 37 stories. The book says 36, but count them, there's 37. There's 37 stories in the back of that book. They had 16 years to work and rework those 12 steps. To my knowledge, all 37 of those people either died happy and sober or alive happy and sober. Now let's go back to the other one. I got all but two of the complete set of that thing, too. Book came out April 1939. First time the print. Back of that book, 29 stories. One of them is the wife of an alcoholic. What was it, 12 years or 13 years before Al-Anon, genealogy, something like that. The other were 28 alcoholics. One of them was a woman named Florence Rankin. The other 27 were men. They held hands. They came to meetings and they said the Lord's Prayer. And six of them committed suicide. Now you tell me the steps are... It's the only program I've got, man. I read it just a few minutes ago. Here are the steps we took which are suggested as a what, man? A program about recovery. It's the only program I got. Going to meetings and not drinking does not treat my alcoholism. Let me tell you another right quick. Don't let me tell this new guy, don't worry about those steps. You'll know when it's time to take the steps. I was doing this one time. You know what my big book said? He read that on page 58 a while ago. If you want what we have, Rod, and you're willing to go to any lengths to get it, Rod, he says, then, Rod, not a week from next Tuesday at 2:15, but then, Rod, you're ready to take certain steps. I was doing the big book out in Los Angeles, 6 weeks of that started. I got through the fifth chapter, and this little girl came up to me, and she says, Rod, my sponsor says don't touch a fourth step for a year. You know what my sponsor says? More people are killed with bad information than there are alcohol. I believe that. I believe that with all my life. That night in Los Angeles, I says, let's flip this thing over just a minute on page 64. At the top of the page, it says, though our decision, third step, right? Though our decision was a vital and crucial step, it had little permanent effect unless at once. Now, damn it, what does it take for us intellectuals to figure out what time we're supposed to do this thing? At once, followed by a strenuous effort to face and be rid of those things in ourselves that had been blocking us from what? Blocking us from turning our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. And then if you think you've still got a problem with alcoholism because alcohol is your problem, the next sentence says, our liquor was but a symptom. Our liquor. God, I go into the doctor with pneumonia and I'm coughing. He don't treat my cough. That's a symptom. He treats my pneumonia. Let's don't treat our alcohol. Let's treat our alcoholism. I'm going to tell you one more, and it's going to get you quiet. You've been so nice, I hate to do this. I really do. But I made a promise to me, I made a promise to my wife, and I made a promise to my sponsor and my higher power I used to get up here and say what I thought y'all wanted to hear. I don't do it anymore. Don't let me tell that newcomer that the only thing you've got to do is just turn it over to God. Boy, you get quiet, don't you? I'm sorry about that. That ain't my big book. That's called church. And it works for millions. Works for millions. If all I had to do is just turn it over to God, why didn't my 10,000 prayers work? Why didn't my mother's 10,000 prayers work? Why didn't church work for me? You know what my mother and the preacher always said? This is what I heard them say. You've got to know and do God's will. Oh, God, I wanted that more. There's not a person in this room. Al Capone never got up in the morning and looked in the mirror and said, okay, Al, baby, today you ain't going to do God's will. We don't do it that way. You've got to know and do God's will. You know what y'all told me? It's on page 68. Let's read it real fast. Just to the extent that we do as we think He would have us, normally rely on Him, does He enable us to match calamity with serenity? Real slow now. Y'all, mother said, you've got to know and do God's will. Y'all said, just to the extent that we do as we think He would have us. Just to the extent that we work and rework the 12 steps and humbly rely on Him. Humbly rely on what? Humbly rely on the results of working and reworking the 12-step program of alcoholism. What's going to happen? He's going to just take it and run with it and I turn it over to Him. That ain't what the book says. You know, God ain't going to do nothing for me I can do for me. The book says He's going to help me. Does He enable me to what? The most beautiful 147 promise of the big book. Does He enable me to match calamity with serenity? The further down the pits of alcoholism I've been, the higher up the ladders makes you feel kind of sorry for those high-bottom drunks, don't it? It makes it easier to read when we get over to page 124, I believe it is, too, in the book where it says, cling to the thought, Rod, that in God's hands, your dark past is the greatest possession you've got. What is Kathy, is our relationship? Why is it like it is? Is it because she sang too loud in the choir? It's because I did everything right. Oh, no. Cling to the thought, Rod. Your dark past is the greatest possession you got. I'd like in this 12th step, y'all, when working with new people, I'd like to try to posture my life to go by that little responsibility creed we see on so much of our pretty literature that simply says, when anyone anywhere reaches out for help, I want the hand of Alcoholics Anonymous. Not the cliches, the metaphors, nor the opinions of Rod Causton. But the accurate hand of Alcoholics Anonymous to be there. And for that, I am responsible. I wasn't going to tell you this tonight. I'm going to sit down after 2 minutes. But somebody asked me last night, would I tell this? And I'm going to do it. Let me tell you about my fear. The idiots heard it. It hasn't been very long ago. I end this with something a little bit lighter. I've been talking to Zer. It hadn't been very long ago I would have told you I wasn't afraid of anything. And I really wouldn't have been lying to you. Because the real things I'm not afraid of. We used to jump out of airplanes when I was a kid up there in North Arkansas, up around Dardanelle, up there when I was dusting cotton. And us kids said, I bet you wait, I'd wait longer than you can to pull, you know, all that. I wasn't scared of nothing. But I'm terrified of things. You know I am. The main thing, like the insidiousness of the disease, I'm terrified. I'm terrified of letting down on my program. But my fear now is this. You know, I think the guy that put that little public address system on airplanes, whereby the captain can talk to his passengers, I think that guy had it in for me. That's not paranoia either. This little nemesis of mine started back in the early 1960s when I first started flying captain. And I very confidently picked up this microphone to talk to my passengers. And I says, ladies and gentlemen, we're pissing over Pittsburgh. You know. That's a truth, by the way. That was later chronicled in a book that was written in 1966. I have said every dumb thing that can be said over a public address system. My fear now is this, y'all. You know, I go to an awful lot of Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, and in every one of them, at one time or another, I'll say, my name is Rod Causton. I'm an alcoholic. Someday I'm going to get on that airplane. And I'm going to say, ladies and gentlemen, this is your captain, Ron Costa, and I'm an alcoholic. Thank you so very much.